You're attending a shiur at L1 Capital. If you'd like to know about future shiurim and future guest speakers, after the shiur, please speak to Jeff Lamb in the office next door. If you ask for Jeff, and he'll take down your email address and he will add you to the L1 Capital mailing list. It appears from the number of people today that I don't need to introduce Rabbi Tarragon is the reason why we have so many people here this afternoon. It is a real pleasure and privilege to welcome Rabbi Tarragon back yet again to be inspiring us and educating us in Melbourne, and I'm not going to take away any more of your time, but thank you for joining us. Rabbi Tarragon arrived just this morning. He's come straight in to teach us, and we're really excited to hear your words.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me in the back? I'll start with sitting, and then I'll try to stand in a few moments. First of all, Yashar Koach, Rabbi Mervis, thank you for welcoming me so warmly. It's a pleasure to see how electrifying your impact is on the community. So keep up, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give you the koach. Thank you to Robert and to Ruth Epstein, my incredible host. It's worth a trip just to come and be hosted in your family, in your warm home. And thank you to Rafi. Is Rafi here? Rafi, you should get a lot of merit in Shemayim for creating such a center of Torah in the middle of Melbourne. So one of the great failures of the first Beis HaMikdash, when we think about Tisha B'Av, a lot of our attention is on the second Beis HaMikdash because it's the Romans, it's the Greeks, it's the Jews, it's Rabbi Akiva, the 10 martyrs, recency bias. There's a lot to talk about in the second Beis HaMikdash. First Beis HaMikdash, not so much. Ancient, thousands of years ago. We don't study Tanakh that well as much as we should. So a lot of our imagination gets wrapped around the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, the 10 martyrs, all the stories. First Beis HaMikdash, a little bit remote. One of the failures of the first Beis HaMikdash was the hijacking of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's word by false prophets. All these false prophets assuring the people that their parties would continue, that all these prophecies of doom wouldn't materialize, they could continue on their merry ways. One prophet, Yirmiah, he's defiant. Yirmiah says it as it is, blows the whistle, stands in people's face, tells them that the destruction is looming. Of course, he's threatened, he's incarcerated at some point. God has to embolden him, don't worry, I'll support you. So Yirmiah is the tragic figure of the first Beis HaMikdash. And it's so tragic because he doesn't just prophesy about the destruction, but he lives through it. And as he lives through it, he writes Eicha, and you can hear his shriek, and you can feel the oozing pain, watching the destruction that he had foretold, that he had informed people, and now he's living through it. So he authors that book, Eicha, but he begins the book with a really odd word. And he doesn't just begin the book with the word Eicha, but there are two other prakim. Of course, he doesn't structure the prakim. The chapters are created later. But there are sections twice in addition to the first Eicha. Eicha, Yeshva Badad, Eicha Yuam, Makesef Esahav. It's a very strange word. Most of Tanakh begins in a descriptive fashion. Who's the prophet? When did he live? What period? The timeline? We need to know who the figures are, who the prophets are, possibly a little bit more poetic, Divrei Koheles, Koheles Hashlomo's nickname, Shir Hashirim Hashel Hashlomo. So most of Tanakh begins in a pretty descriptive fashion. Who, what, where, timelines. This lament about Yerushalayim, how? How did it happen? Very strange word. Eicha. But evidently the word is resonant, and evidently the word is iconic, because it isn't just Yirmiah who employs this term. There are two other Nevi'im who begin very pivotal statements with the same term. And you know one of them, we all know both of them. One will read on Shabbos, Moshe Rabbeinu, Eicha salavadi, torchachem emasachem v'rivchem. So if you take a look at source number one, Moshe Rabbeinu stands in the desert. This is, of course, in Parshas Devarim, but it's nostalgic, thinking what happened when they first left Mitzrayim. Echa asal avadi tarchachem, line two, source one, masachem berivchem. The Jewish people had grown so exponentially that their needs had surged in Moshe, Parshas Yisro. This is Parshas Devarim, but retelling Yisro. When Moshe Rabbeinu was answering their questions and attending to their needs from dawn till dusk, Yisro visits. He's worried sick. Moshe will wilt. Moshe will collapse. So Yisro, Moshe's father-in-law, encourages him to delegate some authority. So Moshe employs the term Eicha. Not only did Yirmiah employ the term Eicha, or Moshe, but Yeshaya. And Yeshaya's Eicha will, of course, figure in this week's Haftarah, Parshas Chazon. What does Yeshaya write? Source number two. Echa haisal zona kirya ne'amana. How did the city, which is renowned for justice, become a den of murder? How did a city that stood for morality descend into prostitution? Echa haisal zona kirya ne'amana. Echa. There's something about this word that's very iconic. Yirmiyah, Yeshaya, Moshe, and Chazal note this triplication. Source number four, Echa Yashva, a Medrash, Shlosha Nisnabu Belashon Echa. Moshe, Yeshaya, V'Yirmiyah. Line number two, Moshe, Echa Selavadi. Yeshaya, Echa Selazona. Line three, Yirmiyah, Echa Yashva Badad. What makes this word so crucial? It just seems to be a pretty generic, functional word. How descriptive, interrogation. The word Echa carries two connotations, or more literally, the word how. Echa means how. When we employ the word how, often it's inquisitive. How do you get from one place to another? How do you build a building? How do you compute a math equation? So typically the word how is inquisitive, searching for answers, looking for information that's yet to be discovered. But sometimes in life, the word how is a response to an experience which is so baffling and so overwhelming and so almost debilitating, you're just left with this word how lingering on your lips. You hear it, God forbid, of a tragedy. How did it happen? The person who asks how it's, oh, well, by the way, the two cars crashed and there's a five-car collision. And you're not looking for information. Someone died. You're overwhelmed with perplexion. It's just too baffling. You can't wrap your mind around it. And it's almost as if you're exhaling and the only word that you could conjure had it happen. You're not looking for information. You're not looking for a response. You're just flabbergasted. You're just baffled. You just, something like that happened. It's just, imagine how. That's what the term Echa means in these three situations. None of these prophets are asking for information. Echa's, Yirmiyah's not looking for, how did this happen? We know it happened. Ruchanetzar marched in with his band of armies, with his mercenaries, and he ransacked Yerushalayim. Moshe Rabbeinu isn't looking for information. He knows exactly how it happened. But they're responding to the disproportion of Jewish history. God selected us as his people to stand for him in this world. We reflect him. We transmit his messages, the messages of morality, messages of monotheism. But we operate on a different sphere. We aren't governed by the trends and the trajectories and the rhythms and the rules that govern nations. Our growth, our experience, our suffering, our tragedy, our moral decadence, our arc is different. And when you chart it and when you sense it, you're just shocked when you see that Jewish experience doesn't conform, doesn't accommodate typical expectations. We're just different. And our arc is different, and our rhythm is different, our pace is different. And these three prophets are standing and beholding three different stages. They're very different. Some are triumphant, some are tragic, some are morally embarrassing. But the common thread is, it's just atypical. And just standing on the sidelines say, how does this happen? This is just different. This is just irrational. So, for example, Moshe, let's follow the Medrash, source number four, Moshe, line number three, Ra'as Yisrael b'chvodam. Moshe lives during triumph. A couple of weeks ago, there were a band of slaves. For 210 years, their imaginations were crushed by brutal oppression. And now they're about to stand at Har Sinai and introduce monotheism into this world. Monotheism is a hard religion. Not an easy religion. God can't be seen. God can't be described. God can't be spoken. But you have to love him and have a relationship with him. It's an amazing combination. We love HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but we can't even see him, or describe him, or mention his name. So this band of slaves, which had been persecuted for decades, for centuries, All of a sudden, slaves don't have a society. They don't know what a family is. Now all of a sudden in the desert, Moshe, how do we construct a society of ethics and justice and morality and kindness? Let's ask questions. You know the scene in the beginning of Yisrael. A couple of weeks after Mitzrayim. They had lived in survival mode for hundreds of years, and now they're thinking about social justice and political integrity and religious inspiration and spiritual input. And Moshe's just shocked. So Moshe says, Echa Esa Levadi, Tarchachem U'masachem. He's not looking for an answer. He's not going, well, Moshe, this is the way you should handle their needs. Moshe's just shocked at this exponential growth, that a band of slaves can morph in 7 weeks into the Jewish people standing at Har Sinai and reshaping human consciousness. And he's just shocked because we don't operate based on normal national trends. That would take hundreds of years for another nation to achieve. And for us, it's 7 weeks. And Yeshaya stands in Jerusalem watching the moral depravity, and he's just shocked. Part of the reason we were chosen by God, not because we're smarter, because we're more wealthy, because our DNA is superior, these are all bigoted and untrue. We were selected by Hashem for several traits we have. First of all, because we have a capacity for supernaturalism, capacity for prophecy, to see beyond the material world. But also, the reason Jews are chosen, let's face it, we're pretty stubborn people. We don't take no for an answer. We've got a backbone. We're willing to defy our world. We're willing to be Avraham HaIvri. We're willing to stand on one side and look at the other side, and conviction, belief, strength. This is what we believe in. I'm Sheyarif. I'm not going to be swayed. We have strength of character, strength of belief, which sometimes backfires. Because during the first Beis HaMikdash, you'd think the prophecy, and you'd think the supernatural miracles, and you'd think the Beis HaMikdash, and you'd think divine intervention would serve as a corrective against this moral freefall, this moral spiral that we sense. Let's face it, we tend to over-glorify the past. Oh, we're all midgets. People in the past, they were heroic, they were righteous. That is a false narrative, and it's an enfeebling narrative. Oh yeah, we're just midgets. They were great. They were tzaddikim. We're meaningless. We lead empty lives. I'll have to talk about that a little bit over the weekend, but it's false. The first Beis HaMikdash was a terrible, pathetic period. Complete moral chaos. Adultery, idolatry, murder, many other issues. How could a nation blessed with a temple, blessed with supernaturalism, the writings on the wall, the prophets came and warned them, but we said, maybe we'll just continue. Maybe we'll continue our merry ways, because we're obstinate, because we're strong-willed, because when we sense a certain reality, we stick to it. Generally, that's favorable. Generally, that's helpful. Sometimes it's destructive. So, Yeshaya, source number 4, let's get back to the Medrash. Moshe ras Yisrael b'chvoda. Moshe sees the Jewish people during triumph, during this exponential growth. Yeshaya, source 4, line 2, rosam b'pachzusam, sees the Jewish people while they're unraveling and unfurling and just free fall. And he's just shocked how other nations typically, there'd be some moderation, there'd be some temperance. They'd see we have a base on mikdash. We can't. Jewish people, no holds barred. And of course, Yirmiyah, last word of the Medrash, rosam b'nivulam. Yirmiyah sees how much they suffered. And when Yirmiyah sees the suffering, he doesn't just see what happens during that first Beis HaMikdash. Yirmiyah is a prophet. He's looking long term. He's looking at the unfolding of Jewish history throughout the generations. Why? Why did the Jews suffer so disproportionately? Why did the Jews suffer so lopsided? Rome conquered so many cultures, but their secret was, don't eliminate those cultures. Subdue the cultures, suppress the cultures, collect their coinage, collect their soldiers. This is how they built an empire. They didn't murder. They murdered a couple thousand, and then they suppressed the rest of the Jewish people. Mikdash is ransacked. Jerusalem is assaulted. 10 martyrs are pursued. There's something about the Jewish people that irked Rome. It wasn't just the rebellion. It's what we stood for. We stood for monotheism, not polytheism. We stand. We're the whistleblowers. We challenge the world to higher moral ground. Because of that, we're hated. Anti-Semitism, I'll speak about this on Tisha B'Av. Anti-Semitism is not incidental. It's not because the Jew acts inappropriately in public or is caught embezzling or, of course, those are inexcusable. Anti-Semitism is woven into history because we are Hashem's people. We stand for him. We challenge the world. Of course, thank God we live in a world in which anti-Semitism is significantly curtailed, significantly, thank God, defeated. But it will end in total when history ends. Because our challenge in this world is to stand on that other side and call the world to higher ground. Call the world to a life of morality. Call the world to a life of monotheism. And no one likes a whistleblower. It's easier to have people who affirm whom you are, who ratify your reality, than who challenge your reality. So when Yirmiyah stands in Yerushalayim and he witnesses the ferocity, the brutality, not just of the Nebuchadnezzar, but of the Romans, not just of the Romans, but of the Spaniards, and of the English, and of the Polish, and of the Jews, says, Eicha, how? Eicha yeshva badad? Because after all, we have a universal mission. We're meant to be the nation of the world, yet the world hates us. Eicha yeshva badad. How did we become so isolated and lonely and different and alienated? But they're all sensing the same narrative, and they're all distilling that narrative with the same word, Eicha. Eicha is not a technical word. Eicha is the password of Jewish history. Jewish history will never be proportionate. It will always be supernatural. And we're living through that sequel. Every good movie has a sequel. I think I watched about 30 seconds of a movie on my two flights just because I wanted to see what the movie is. I like that Avengers Endgame. My kids seem to like it. I saw the first half of a scene. Right, with this bow and arrow or something, but the first half of the scene. So every good movie has a sequel, or a couple sequels. We're now living through the sequel. Same story, that's why it's a sequel. Just want to make more money off of the same plot line. But basically, we're living through the sequel. 80 years ago, nations have been hated, nations have been despised, nations have been... Holocaust was different. Holocaust was a different story. It can't be compared. It's a shift in history. Hitler was caught. They found in Hitler's bunker a list of 250 Albanian Jews. You'd think he's got enough on his mind. He's fighting a war on two fronts, with the Russians to the east and with the Allies to the west. You'd think he's got better things to do than to collect 250 names. You'd think he's got better things to do than to identify synagogues in New York City and locate their blueprints because he wanted to dismantle them when he invades New York. It's just different. And then 80 years later, the state of Israel, we didn't just survive the Holocaust. We thrived. We didn't just thrive. We reshaped the world. And we built a superpower in every single sector, educationally, politically, financially, militarily, culturally. How? That doesn't happen in 70 years. And we happened to pick a pretty difficult neighborhood to build our state. It's not exactly a calm neighbor. We didn't build it on the outskirts of Melbourne. A couple of homicidal maniacs aligned on our borders looking to destroy us, and they've got all the natural resources. And you're just, how does this happen? How does a nation gyrate so exponentially and then suffer as we did and then respond and the resilience and... Because our history isn't natural. Chazal spoke about this, Ein Mazal Yisrael. Because in Chazal's terminology, it was zodiac and heavenly forces and predetermination. And those are all true, but that's not the world we live in. We don't live in a world of zodiac and metaphysical forces. We live in a world of empiricism, rationalism, geopolitics. So just take what Chazal said and translate it to our world. Ein Mazal Yisrael means the Jewish people aren't governed by the typical patterns that govern other nations. Which is different, because Hashem selected us, and we hover above history, and sometimes we suffer, and sometimes we triumph, but in each instance, it's the same sense of, this is different. This is something which is mystifying. This is too perplexing. How? Come on, is there anyone in this room who can describe the last 71 years of the state of Israel, other than saying, just, how does this happen? And you're not looking for an answer. Of course, I could clearly delineate, but you string every act together, right? The nature of grand historical miracles is if you just isolate every single change in every single event, they can all be rationalized. But when you loop them together as one series, they're just overwhelmingly irrational. Okay, well, we know how we won the 67. But then how did it happen in 73? What about this battle? What about this then? And when you just string them together, the totality is just baffling. The sequencing is just irrational. And that's why Yirmiyah begins his sefer with the word Eicha. And that's why the word Eicha is so iconic. I don't just mean how does it happen. When we say Amir Tashem, Matzei Shabbos, Eicha, that's the password of Jewish history. Entering the inquiry of Jewish history means suspend your ration. Don't expect to chart it the way you chart history. Chart it prophetically. Chart it supernaturally. That lesson was first delivered to Yirmiyah at a different stage. I don't know when he wrote Eicha, vis-a-vis when he wrote Sefer Yirmiyah, but there's a different scene in Yirmiyah which is exactly parallel to Eicha. Typically, prophets speak with their tongues, deliver a message, stand on a soapbox, warn the people, stand in the marketplace. But sometimes prophets are meant to act out their messages. So Yirmiyah is now standing in the ruins of Yerushalayim. So it's around the Eicha time. We don't know when he actually pens Eicha, but it's the Eicha period of his life, not the pre-Eicha period of his life. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to demonstrate redemption. So he asks Yirmiyah to purchase land from his friend Baruch Ben Neriah. Now, when I tell you that there's no market for land in Yerushalayim, I mean there's no market. There's no lawyers. There's no law. Jerusalem has fallen. Essentially, it's in flames. The Babylonians have invaded. The ramparts have been built. Essentially, it's not like it's a cheap and depressed real estate market. There's no real estate market. It would be like asking Yirmiyah to purchase land in Fallujah or in Mosul. There's no market. You can't locate lawyers. It's a free-for-all. It's a Wild West. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructs him to purchase land. And Yirmiyah responds to Hashem, source number 8. And essentially, Yirmiyah's point is, I understand that we can't get your ways, and your ways are beyond human comprehension, and you're indecipherable. I'm a prophet. I get the concept. I've read Sefer Iyov. That's Sefer Iyov. Man can't penetrate the divine will. Gadol Haitzah, source number 8, line 3. Barav Haliliyah, you're the master of all wisdoms. Asher Inecha Pekuchos HaKol Darchei Bnei Adam, your eyes see all of human experience. Line number 4, but Hineh Solos Bo Ha'ir, the ramparts are built. Ve'er Nitna Biad Kastim, and the city is being overrun by these mercenaries. Remember, Hevi B'chol Yaseh Bnei Ashpasa, we'll read this Matzei Shabbos. You have sent in our direction the dregs of earth. It's not just that Jews, as a pasuk in Eicha, not just that Jews have suffered, but when we suffer, it's not just our enemies, but one level lower in the food chain. We didn't just suffer at the hands of the Germans, but the Germans sent the Ukrainians after us. And the Ukrainians in Europe were the dregs of Europe. Not all Ukrainians, but those of them. There's always the mercenaries. So the mercenaries of the Babylonians were called the Kastim. These were these ferocious, merciless freaks of nature that came marauding through town. So Hevi Bechili Yaseh B'nei Ashpasah, we'll read this Matzei Shabbos, B'nei Ashpasah means the dregs of society. When we suffer, it's not just our enemies, but they're mercenaries. So the Kastin have now invaded the city. There's pestilence, there's swords, there's hunger. Line number 3 from the bottom, source 8. V'ata amarta elai Hashem b'lokim k'nelecha asada b'kesef v'hayit eidim. And you want me to purchase land? Hashem, I'm a prophet. Don't lessen me. I know that I can't understand your ways, but this is preposterous. Purchasing land in Yerushalayim, it's ridiculous. So Hashem responds with one word. It's a cousin of Eicha. It's not Eicha, but it's a cousin. Last line. Hinei ani Hashem lokei kol basar, hamimeni yipalei kol davar. Is there anything which to me is a pella? Pella means mystery. I know that it mystifies you, but human beings process history in swaths of 100 years, 500 years. Prophets have a more panoramic view. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu transcends time. V'Kadosh Baruch Hu, time is 1,000 years is a second. Ki Elif Shanim Be'Necha Ki Yom Esmol. And you see destruction in Yerushalayim, but I see rebuilding, and I see redemption, and I see Jews returning. And you can't envision that, but purchase the land now as a symbol for Jewish return. You'll be the first Jew, the first Zionist is Yerbia. Actually, it's not because they come back in the second Beis HaMikdash. The first person to purchase land in Yerushalayim is Yerbia. If he could only hold on to the deed, he'd be a very wealthy prophet, right? Especially for Mamila or the center of town or near the Waldorf Astoria. He's purchasing land somewhere as a symbol. For many years, I was in charge of recruitment and admissions in the yeshiva. So I wanted to know how much Gemara they could read and how they daven and who they were as people and their chesed. But I also wanted to know who they were as a Jew. I think it's important to be a good Jew, not just a firm Jew, but a good Jew. Here's a good mental experiment. Close your eyes. You have to close your eyes. You'll probably fall asleep. But make believe you're closing your eyes. Who's the best Jew you ever met in your life? I mean, the top Jew, that person, he or she, proud, statehood, peoplehood, history. But here's the catch. They can't be religious. Try to separate Jewishness from religion. We want to be both. We want them to be fused. Who is the best Jew you ever met who wasn't religious in the classic sense? To me, it's Menachem Begin. I don't know how religious he was or wasn't, but that man just stepped out of Menachem. I mean, his voice was the voice of Jewish history. So I like to ask kids on the interview, if you could climb into a time machine and visit one stage of Jewish history, where would you travel to? One stage. Pick a stage. So you get all the classic answers, Matan Torah, Kriyas Yamsov, 48, creation of the world, 95% of the answers. I'm sitting there like falling asleep because I know the answers. Saying the answers. About 10 years ago, I was giving an interview, and a boy said to me, Rabbi, what would your answer be? So first of all, I gave him a big check for chutzpah, you know, from my seat. This guy's in, you know, I don't care whether he reads Gemara or not. I just like this guy's spirit. You know? So got like a whole series of three or four answers. If they say something, every once in a while, I'll ask a boy, tell me about your family relationships. Who do you room with at home? So every once in a while, a boy will say, well, my grandfather lives in our home, and I share a room with him. So little does he know that he's in yeshiva once he gives me that answer, because you can learn a lot more from sharing a room with your grandfather than all the pages of Bava Kama. So you know, this boy's got character. He's coming to my yeshiva. Give him a big check. Anyway, so he asked me, "Where are you? What would you say, Rabbi?" I said, if I could go to one part of Jewish history, I'd want to walk out with the survivors in 1945. Just walk out of the concentration camps. Why? What was the first thing they did? First thing they did, find a niece, a friend, a sister's friend from the shtetl, remarry, rebuild, have children, name after the people who were killed. And you have to ask yourself, how could they bring children into such a nightmarish world? 2020 hindsight lets us know that those children born in 46 and 47, 48, these would be heroes of history. They'd live in Israel, many of them. They'd fight in the independence war. They'd rebuild our state. They'd march in the fields of redemption. But they didn't know that. And what type of moral energy must it have taken for these people just to raise their families afresh without knowing what the conclusion of this episode was? Because sometimes in life you just need moral conviction. And you just need to leave the broader calculus to Hashem. You just have to do what's right, even though you don't understand the broader calculus, how it's going to factor, what will happen. Sometimes human beings are caught in this maelstrom of chaos, and you just have to hold tight to moral values and religious responsibilities, and say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of the larger. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will deal with the larger. I just do what's right. I raise my family. I stand by my values. I stick to my guns. Like Kadosh Baruch Hu worry about. Hashem's pretty good at math. Hashem took calculus in college. He knows how to work out the algorithms. He'll work out the broader algorithms of our world. I'll stick to what's right. And I would just want to sense their moral energies. Walking out of Auschwitz and rebuilding, not knowing. So we don't know. We don't know history. And so Yirmi is shocked. And Kadosh Baruch Hu says, how many people are called over? it's mystifying to you, but to me it isn't. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers this term, Pei Lamed Aleph, mystery, as the password of Jewish history. Mystery is the description, Eicha is the human response. Jewish history is a Pella. When human beings try to understand that history, we just exhale. It's not even a word. You're just exhaling. You're exasperated. How does this happen? There's too much to compute. Too much for the human imagination to wrap its mind around. And that same lesson of Pella is delivered not to Yirmiyah, but to Zechariah. Very famous prophecy, Zechariah. Zechariah is a very apocalyptic prophecy. He sees horsemen in heaven, golden candelabras. It's very apocalyptic. It's not just terrestrial. A lot of dreams, a lot of mysterious images. So let's listen to Zechariah's apocalypse. Very famous line, last phrase, last source. Ka'amar Hashem Tzevakos, od yeshivu zekenim u'zekenos v'erchovos u'yushalayim v'ish mishan tober v'yado merov yamim. Elderly people will stroll calmly through the streets of Jerusalem with their canes. Urchovos ha'ir yimalu yiladim v'ilados misachkim v'erchovos ha. The streets will be filled with children frolicking. You're listening to the apocalypse? These are pretty pastoral scenes. Nothing apocalyptic here. No mountains being pulverized. No planets being ransacked. No blood spilling from heaven. No strange, mysterious creatures. Why is this an apocalyptic prophecy? Because what is normal for every single nation is apocalyptic for Jews. For every single nation, people growing old enough to have canes and children playing freely in streets, that's just normal. That's typical. Nothing to see here. Keep moving. It's just standard fare. But for Jews, to grow old enough to walk with canes and for children to frolic in streets, how elusive has it been? How hard have we fought for that? And we still don't have it. Because kids in sterile can't freely play in the streets when sirens sound. And kids in up north in Kiryat Shemona always have to worry where the next shelter is. So what's normal in Norway is apocalyptic in Kiryat Shemona. And what's typical Los Angeles is apocalyptic in Dimona or in Sderot. And that's why it's included in Zechariah's Nevuah. My Rabbi Rav Amital would tell us that when he survived the Holocaust and moved to Israel, he lived in Givat Mordechai and he studied in the Hebron Yeshiva. And he would walk to the yeshiva every day and pass by the playground, and he would stand there transfixed, crying for hours, just watching the kids play. Because those same eyes, which had witnessed Jewish children being lined up against stony walls in Europe and being summarily executed, were now witnessing these prophecies. Part of our challenge in the modern era is to somehow take this book and superimpose it to our reality. It's one of the challenges of being a modern Jew. Look around you. I don't see any goats. I don't see any shepherd's men. I don't see any sandal-wearing prophets. It feels different. Tall skyscrapers, large glass windows, trains, planes, cranes. But prophecy is superimposed. We're living. They can't necessarily take a specific pasuk and superimpose it because of this pasuk. Therefore, not that direct. That's very dangerous. But the general sense that the book of Tanakh has now been flung open after being closed for 2,000 years. For 2,000 years, Tanakh was dormant. It existed, but just spiritually. It's an undercurrent. It always exists. But in the world of optics, in the world of experience, in the world of human history, Tanakh had been shut tight. But now we're returning, and now we're back, and now we've been empowered to be an international force. And now the Jewish people are once again being reestablished on the world stage. And now let's look back to Tanakh and at least derive some direction, some spirit, some reinforcement. That's a gift which Rav Amital gave his students. Read Tanakh and then try to wed it or meld it to reality. And then let's listen to the end of Zechariah's description of these old women, old men being old enough to hold canes without being prematurely murdered and children frolicking. Line number, last line, but this will end. Ki yipalei b'nei she'eres ha'amazeh. The people who will live to see these scenes will be shocked. Ki yipalei, the same term. Here's the hyperbole. End of the line. Source number 9. Gam b'enai yipalei no'am Hashem. I'll also be shocked, Hashem says. That's false. Hashem isn't shocked. It's hyperbolic. It will be so perplexing. It will be so irrational. It will be so lopsided that I'll be shocked, as it were. Not only will the people who live through this experience be shocked, but I'll be shocked as well. No Moshe. Those are the two passwords to Jewish history. Password Pella. Hamimeni Yipalei Kol Davar. Source number 8. It's a mystery. Ki Yipalei Be'enei She'eres ha'amazeh. Gam Be'enei Yipalei No Hashem Zechariah. It's a mystery. When we stand in front of that abyss, unable to decipher, we're just left exhaling. Echa. This is beyond the human experience. It's Tisha B'Av 2019. It's a very different feel than Tisha B'Av 1619. Tisha B'Av 1619, we're all in Europe. We just suffered a pogrom, at the very least 3 months ago during Easter. We all lost someone at some point. We're all living with collective trauma, Spain, Poland, Germany, England, wherever we are. Some of us are living in Arabic lands, constant pogroms, constant... Anywhere without the pogroms, discrimination, persecution, belittlement. So we lock into the depth and the teeth of the gulf, or the belly of the beast. We're literally living in the belly of the beast, and we're suffering, and it's agony, and we shriek, and it's a nightmare. It's different now. Let's be honest. It's different. It's more panoramic. Don't ignore the last 3,000 years. But now you're standing at the top of the mountain and you're looking at the entire landscape and saying, what has happened to our people over the last 3,000 years? It wasn't meant to happen. It should have been easier. It could have been easier. But now we've survived and there's triumph and there's tragedy and we're sad. There's a panoramic nature to it. We're able to relate to the entire sweep from a vantage point that our ancestors never had. And it's not less painful, it's just a different mix of success and triumph and gratification, but we want more, and because our palates have been whetted, our appetites have been whetted, we want so much more, and we're frustrated that we're not there, but we're thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and for a Jew, triumph and tragedy, same thing. We're his people, we challenge the world. We're meant to challenge the world in a messianic period in which the world is ready for our challenge and eager to accept our challenge. We live in a broken world. The world's still seething at our challenge. But those aren't that different. And that's why Chazal are trying to merge Moshe and Yirmiyah and Yeshaya by that one common word. So for the next couple of days, get a sense of the panoramic nature of Tisha B'Av and how to travel through the odyssey of Jewish history and enrich our Tisha B'Av. So thank you everyone for coming.
Thank you very much. 8:30 p.m. At Mizrahi this evening, Rabbi Targum will be giving a shiur. Everybody's welcome. Look out for Rabbi Targum's full schedule while he's here. In particular, I want to mention on Sunday morning, Kinot with Rabbi Targum after the 8 a.m. shachrit until Chatzot, which means there'll be the 8 a.m. shachrit followed by